Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Yes, Michael Steele. I'm back in the neighborhood. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. You know how that goes. You can also find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. So check out all the good stuff happening there. Well, I'm excited about today's friend who showed up because she and I have actually been in battle against each other back in 2010, and we have been colleagues at MSNBC together. And I'd like to think throughout all of those trials and crazy times that we kind of grew a friendship. And she's a great lady. She is the one and only Crystal Ball, co-host of the Hill's daily politics show Rising, which you can catch on Hill TV. She was, as I mentioned, a host at MSNBC for a bit. She was also the Democratic Party nominee for Congress in Virginia's 1st District in that wonderful 2010 cycle.
Yeah, you guys beat my butt.
You know
it's
what?
All right, it all worked out. It all worked out.
This is true, you know. But, you know, this is one of the lessons of politics, Crystal, making the point you just did, is that when you catch people, you know, particularly candidates in the blind, in other words, you're coming in, you're engaging the local party, saying, oh, this is the worst person since sliced bread, and you're gearing up and you're, you know, going into that battle, you realize either during and certainly afterwards that this is a human being, it's, you know, it's a family and, you know, businesswoman, she's smart, she's got all this stuff going on. And she's not this ogre who wants to destroy our, you know, our way of life, as people would say. So that's,
not that I've divulged yet anyway.
Yeah, exactly. That's coming. But, you know, it says a lot about our politics today, I think, you know, where we are. And I really want to thank you for taking the time out, because I know you're busy doing your show and everything, and a lot of stuff going on with the baby, new baby, and family. Oh, absolutely. So, but it does speak to our times that we're in right now, where what we think we know or what we've come to accept is getting questioned about people and ideas and values. And I think that's really challenging right now for a lot of people. And where I think it's symbolized, or beginning to symbolize itself in our current moment, beyond Trump, is what's going on right now in the Democratic primary process, where what I'm seeing, and I'd be interested in your thoughts here, this tension between a more progressive element with the party, which has found its footing. I won't say begun to find. I think they firmly found it. Now they're trying to re-step. Or remake the steps of the party going into the future, as a, you know, up against its more traditional sort of establishment party official types, represented, for example, by Ocasio-Cortez, Warren, Sanders in the first instance, and Joe Biden in the latter. How do you see that? Before we get into some specifics about Biden's latest controversy, that playing out for someone like you, who, yes, you're a liberal, you're a progressive, but I've always found you brought to the conversation, when we've debated at least, a level of, okay, I see your point, but, you know what I'm saying? At least it wasn't a total shutdown. maybe you're just being a polite host or something, but.
Ideologically, I am very left. I mean, I'm actually writing a column right now about how AOC is the hero that the Democratic Party needs. So just like to center where my politics
are.
However, I'm not a hater, right? And I think that's, I think that's the difference. And, you know, in terms of the primary, it's to me, actually awesome to see the amount of ideas that are being put out. Because I think, in my view, the party's been kind of static for a long time. I mean, we had this Clinton model of how to do politics,
right,
that we've been resting on for a while. And President Obama put a new spin on that, but it was kind of fundamentally the same model. And what 2016 did on the Democratic side, and I think in the country at large, is it was kind of a wake-up call of like, you know what? This way that we've been doing things hasn't been working for a whole lot of people. And we've got to think bigger. We've got to think bolder. We've got to think about the fact that, you know, that we've got 50% of jobs in danger of being automated out of existence. We've got to think bigger about the fact that you have so much of the wealth going to the top and so many people who, yeah, they've got a job, but they still can't afford to feed their family.
Right.
So that part I love. I would argue that the progressive wing of the party has already won. I mean, in terms of you look at the difference between the platforms being offered this cycle versus last cycle, and it's just incredible. I mean, Bernie Sanders' idea of free college, healthcare for everyone, right? Those are mainstream ideas in the party. And also, if you look at like Elizabeth Warren on the rise right now, if you put her and Sanders percentage points together, right, the progressive wing, they're leading the race. So I kind of feel like the progressive wing in a lot of ways has already won. Now, on the other hand, there's a lot of nostalgia for the Obama years that Joe Biden benefits greatly from, right? And people are so desperate to first and foremost beat Donald Trump,
right,
that when they look at the polls and they see Biden as the guy that, you know, does the best against Trump in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, and they say, okay, well, I guess that's the guy we got to go with. The question is whether that perception is going to last.
One other thing
before we jump into Biden that I always want to point out is it all of this that's happening here feels so specific to America, but it's not, right? If we look around the world, there are Trump-like figures rising in Brazil, in Hungary, right? In France, in across Europe. I mean, it's just like in India, right? This is a global movement. So we have to look beyond just beating Trump and really assess like what is causing this particular political moment, not just here, but around the world.
So, before we get into the bites, I want to pick apart a little bit of what some of the points you just made, because while I agree in some large measure with what you just said, here's the problem with the Dems as I see it right now. You're absolutely right about where the party's headed, and you have, I think, made a strong case for that as a progressive. I'm not convinced that's where the country is. And I know a lot of folks, when I look at the 2018 cycle, the proof is in the pudding to what I'm saying, because the vast majority of the Democrats who were elected to the United States Congress, the vast majority of whom were female, were women, were not Ocasio-Cortez Democrats or Bernie Sanders Democrats. They were more moderate Democrats. And I don't know how, and Nancy Pelosi, the erstwhile Speaker of the House and leader of the Democratic Party, made that point as well, as have other non-establishment Democrats recognize that, you know, yeah, the reality on the ground speaks a little bit differently than how people are sort of interpreting that. The second point, though, that I throw out here for you to chew on and spit back at me is, again, to what I said about the country, we can have this debate, and I love debating you on stuff like this. You know, I think the country's center right. You think it's probably more center left, if not left. And I think that's going to be one of the interesting tests of this cycle for the people. To sort of give the political establishments and this newfound energy on the left, as we saw very much on the right 15, 20 years ago, the kind of runway to see exactly where how the American people absorb it and chew on it, and then sort of make it a part of their new political fabric. I'm not convinced that I'm not convinced that they're, you know, people like the idea, and I look at Florida, people like the idea of free health care and free education until they had to answer the question, how do you pay for that in a state with no income tax, no state income tax? And the resultant answer was, we vote for the Republican.
Well, and here's what I would say is that, you know, I think you make a lot of valid points, and you're absolutely right that more of the Democrats that were elected in the midterms were moderates. I mean, there were more blue dogs added to the caucus than there were members of the progressive caucus. Of course, that's a function of the fact that those, you know, where those districts are, how gerrymandered they are, et cetera. But putting that aside.
But they were gerrymandered for Democrats to win. I mean, yeah.
No, they weren't. You won in 2010.
Well, I'm just saying, a Democrat won the seat. So they couldn't have been but so badly gerrymandered if a Democrat of 100 female Democrats pick up those seats, right?
Yeah, but that was in spite of that was a fluke. I mean, we had to win.
Oh, so you guys?
No, we had to win. I mean, you know the numbers. We have to win way more of the popular vote than like if we get 51%, we don't win the House.
40 seats.
Right, I know, because we really overcame massive gerrymandering and had to do way better than winning just.
All right, so what you're
vote.
Saying is we're going to get those seats back next year.
That is certainly a possibility. But no, I mean, my own theory of politics is actually that exact ideological positioning matters a lot less than cultural resonance. Mm-hmm. So where Republicans have done really well is they have been able to culturally connect with predominantly white voters on issues. Some of them, you know, issues like guns, issues like religion, right? I won't even just frame it in terms of like abortion. I would say in terms of religion. And part of it is connecting with white voters in rural areas around sort of racial grievance and their own sense that the country is changing and leaving them behind. And so, you know, I think Republicans have done a very good job of exploiting that sense of the country's changing and I'm uncomfortable with it, even though a lot of the economic policies that have been offered, particularly prior to Trump, actually are really unpopular. And this president, Trump ran as a different kind of Republican. I mean, his, you know, wanting to spend lots of money on infrastructure, right? The tariff stuff, the anti-NAFTA stuff, right? He promised that he was going to cut taxes for the middle class. He promised he was not going to cut taxes for the rich. That was what he ran on. He also ran on health care for all. I mean, these were things that he ran on. He is governed, though, much more like a traditional Paul Ryan type conservative, deciding even to prioritize tax cuts for the rich over his own restrictionist immigration policies. And the way that they've kept the base in line and kept them, you know, in his camp is just straight playing to racial grievance. So so all of that is a long way of saying that, you know, is the country center right? Is the country center left? I think that depends very much on the set of issues you're talking about. I would say if you had to say, you'd say the country was center right on social issues and left, probably more than center left on economic issues. Medicare for all is very popular. The Green New Deal is very popular. Wealth taxes are very popular.
Yeah, but the Green New Deal is just words on paper. There's no policy behind that. Democrats themselves don't even know what that is. They don't know how to shake that up.
Yeah, but that's true of like so many things. I mean, the Green New Deal.
No, it is. It is, but I'm saying in terms of citing that as something the American people are behind is like saying they like water. Okay.
But I don't think that's true.
So?
Previously, things, you know, anything to do with climate change was actually not popular. But what's been smart about the Green New Deal is because you pair it with a job guarantee, right? So it's even bigger government, but it makes sure that, you know, the multiracial working class is going to benefit and not just be on the losing end of the stick there. it has become very popular. So anyway, I think that where the country actually is on ideological issues is probably on the left in economics,
right,
more on the right on social issues. But what people vote for is a lot more about, is this person like me? Do they get me? Am I comfortable with them? Do they sound like me? Those sorts of like gut check type of things tend more often to win the day,
And that raises the point that I want to get into with you about Joe Biden. It is the personalization of politics, which a lot of voters have done going back for a number of years. I've spoken about and written about and talked about incessantly that the rise of the Tea Party in 2009 occurred long before 2009. And in fact, there were elements of it in my race in 2006 for the U.S. Senate. Certainly, there were elements that go all the way back to the emergence of Newt Gingrich as a newly elected member of Congress who brought an attitude to politics that was much more reflective of the disgruntled, disengaged voter who felt the system had basically shit on them for the last fill in the number of year blanks, you know, just it's kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you get to the 2009 cycle, Obama's in the White House, Republicans are in the minority in the House and Senate. I'm sitting there across the street at the RNC looking at this landscape going, what the hell do you do with this? Because Obama was very popular, and the policy direction you thought was going to shift. But what happened was this personalization, how people personally felt, began to feel about their politics, I think took hold. You flash forward from that and all that grew out of that 2009-10 cycle. You were a victim of 2010 as I was a victim in 2006. Where national trend lines and storylines and circumstances mitigated, you know, your achievements and success in your own congressional district, et cetera. People sort of looked at you as they looked at me. You were part of the national problem, you know.
Why would
we vote for that? And so now you have a situation where the Dems, at least Crystal, you know, acknowledge a lot of that and have given some lip service to it. But then when I see what they do and what they're starting to say about Joe Biden, it makes me scratch my head because the things that Joe Biden is getting skewered on right now, and specifically what we're talking about is his comments the other night at a fundraiser in New York, in which he was quoted as saying, quote, I was in a caucus with James O. Eastland, who was notorious segregationist. And, you know, he never called me boy. He always called me son. So I stopped at that point and go, why would you say that? Okay. Of course, he's not going to call you boy. There's a reason for that. Yeah, it's called he looked at you and saw himself. There's another white man. Come on. But then he goes on. Yeah. Well, guess what? At least there was some civility. We got things done. We didn't agree on much of anything. We got things done. We got it finished. But today you look at the other side and you're the enemy, not the opposition, the enemy. We don't talk to each other anymore. That's what he said. And it strikes me that the sort of ad hominem in some respects and certainly disingenuous attacks by folks like Cory Booker, and I agree with Joe Biden, who should know better.
But Biden also said Cory should apologize.
What did you think of that? Well, I know why he
Come
said
on.
That, because he called for Biden to apologize, and Biden was like, fine, I'm not apologizing, he should apologize. And the reason I know how I'd respond. I'd probably say the same thing. What is he asking me to apologize for? I don't have anything to apologize for, because he was not. And this is the part that I want to get to, the personalization of it. You know, we take this how we feel about race and politics and people and all of these things today, and we impose that on the actions and the individuals of a different time and era. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing to do because, you know, whether you're talking about Biden and Anita Hill, where no other Democrat raised their hand and said, Joe, what the hell are you talking about?
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
Right.
They signed up with him on the crime bill. Joe, you're wrong. Maybe this is racist. This is going to lead to blacks being incarcerated unnecessarily. It's going to lead to criminalizing black behavior. Stupid stuff like being black while sitting on the front porch, you know? No one said, no one spoke out against that. Today, everyone has outrageous indignation about it. So how does someone like a Joe Biden deal with this if this is the new environment in which they're going to look at his record and his associations and just sort of apply this standard that no one else applied at that time, no one else applied since then except for now in this moment?
Well, I think here's the way I look at things, and I can't speak for everyone else, but I can speak for myself. I ask myself, who are you today? Right? Who are you today? And when I look at Joe Biden, he hasn't apologized for what he did with the crime bill. He defended it.
Why should he?
You know? Because it led to mass incarceration. It was
but did he
disaster.
Know that
it,
I mean, you apologized
no,
when you,
but,
you
no,
knew
no,
that
no,
was
but,
going to be
but,
a result?
But, right, sure. But even but you can at least look backwards and say, I got it wrong. And so there's that. And then the most recent comment.
So
can I just
push you on that a little bit? So does Joe Biden need to do that now because he's running for president? Or does every other Democrat who served in the United States Senate at that time, who may still be serving, have to do the same thing? Have to make that apology? So there should be a day where every Democrat who's served in the House, in the Senate, come to a public mic and say, I apologize for the crime bill.
If they want to do that, I would be perfectly fine with that. But we're not talking about, I mean, they can handle that in their own individual Senate races. We're talking about President of the United States. Who are you today and what are your policies going to be? And partly what we have to judge that on is what you've done in the past. But partly we also have, you know, your statements of the present day and our own internal gauge of whether you're being upfront, you know, when if you do change positions. And people are very good at judging when you're just pandering and when you actually have reflected on, you know, past actions and decided that you would take a different course if you had it to do over again. I haven't seen that reflection from Joe Biden. And I think that's part of why these comments about Eastland and the other dude whose name I always forget, why these, you know, nasty segregationists, and he brings them up and why it strikes the nerve. Because
Herman Talmadge.
People, yeah,
Talmadge of Georgia.
People, you know, look at that and say, you still don't get it. You don't get it. And it's a foundational, and this is actually my real issue with Biden. I don't think he's racist. I don't, like, that's not what this is about at all. Although I do think that some of the policies that he has championed, including busing, including the crime bill, have led to racist results. But it's more about the fact that he believes we can put this toothpaste back in the tube. We can go back to some bygone era when he could have civility with racist segregationists in the Senate when most people, most people don't want to go back to those times.
But wait a minute. This is where you guys drive me crazy. That's not what he's saying. He's setting that up.
It is what he's saying.
No, he's not saying we can go back to that time. What he's saying, that time should be instructive of how we engage each other now. Let me give you an example of my working with people that I despised, that I disagreed with, but still was able to get some big things done because, as he said, we put in essence, the priority of the country ahead of everything else. I didn't see them as an enemy. They were just my political opponents. What's wrong with that?
I hear you. And I think that is an accurate way of phrasing what he could have stated much more diplomatically and artfully. However, I think he's wrong because we tried for 8 years under Obama. Obama came in with the same view. You got to work with the other side. There are no red states. There are no blue states. It's just the United States. I mean, how many times did he go back to the well to try to get a grand bargain? How hard did he work to try to get one Republican over on health care, right? He adopted
Mitt Romney's freaking
health care reform.
So you guys are just looking for a fight. You want to fight now.
But But hold on. But it didn't work. I mean, if that's your theory of political change, that we're going to be able to go and work with Mitch McConnell, I think that's tremendously naive. And I don't think you're going to get anything done. And that's actually so that is actually my core issue with Biden. You know, he's a little more centrist than me on this or that or whatever. But my real issue is I don't think he understands the moment. I don't think he understands that you're not going to be able to work with the other side. I don't think he understands that Trump's an aberration. I fundamentally disagree with that. And I think it's dangerous to view it that way. The movement that brought Trump to power is so much stronger than Trump himself is, who was like narcissistic, can't see his way past Tuesday. It's the movement that you have to be concerned with. And if you don't take that seriously, that scares me.
I love talking to you. Let me ask you this then. In light of everything you just said, so should Barack Obama apologize for what he said about Senator Byrd when he eulogized him as, quote, as I reflect on the full sweep of his 92 years, it seems to me that his life bent towards justice. This from the former Grand Wizard of the KKK? Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
So Obama needs to find a near side microphone and may start making some apologies here, because he eulogized the former Grand Wizard of the KKK.
Let's just be real, Michael.
Which is nowhere near what
when
Joe
Barack
Biden
Obama
did.
Obama says it, then Joe Biden. Okay, it's a little bit different context here, given their identities.
Okay,
I'm not saying Joe Biden is racist. I'm not even saying he has to apologize. I don't think he should apologize, because I think he totally supports and believes everything that he said. I just think he's wrong. And I'm not going to vote for him.
But is he wrong?
So, the primary.
But you will vote for him in a general.
I don't agree with him.
You will vote for him in a general.
Oh, hell yeah. Over all Donald right Trump, are you kidding and so me? Absolutely.
So at the end of the day, you want to win. So it's better to be woke or to win.
Is it better to be woke or to win? But see, I reject that, because I actually think Joe Biden is a very weak candidate against Donald Trump. I think he's Hillary Clinton all over again.
Who do you think independents and Republicans will move towards in a general election against Donald Trump?
But Michael, look at what they're already doing to Biden.
That's not what center right.
The same playbook that was run against Hillary Clinton. He's corrupt. Look at these deals that Hunter made in China. Look at what happened in Ukraine.
It's not resonating.
Look at his health.
It's not resonating.
They are going to do the same thing. And the whole idea that we're going to run another establishment denizen who's been in D.C. their whole life, and that's the person to go up against Donald Trump, I think he's going to get ripped to shreds.
Yeah, I'll put any one of those other 23 other people up there, and I will see you on the steps of the United States Capitol in January 2021 as you watch one Donald Trump take that oath of office again, because that's exactly what will happen. Exactly.
So you think Biden is the only one who could win?
I think right now, given everything and everyone, this country is not voting for anyone up against Trump other than a Joe Biden. I just don't see it. I don't hear it on the ground. When I travel around, I talk to enough people, I just don't get that vibe that they're buying what. I like Elizabeth Warren. I like her because I think from a policy standpoint, as a Republican, we'd have a field day in debates and discussions about the direction she wants to go. But I just don't think the country's going to buy that. The very people that you talked about at the beginning of our conversation, those people who that center right or that center left group that kind of dabble in and out of these areas around economic and social policy, I just don't think them. I don't see them buying what Elizabeth is selling at a national campaign for the presidency.
I have that concern. I have that concern for sure. I mean, and if you look at, and I don't know how much of that is gender. I think part of it.
I think
is
a lot
gender,
of it's
frankly.
Gender.
but you know, if you look at how she fared in her Senate race, you know, compared to considering how blue a state she was running in Massachusetts, her results were very lackluster. When you take that into account, she had one of the, you know, one of the worst, I can't remember, Nate Silver did the analysis, one of the worst performances relative to, you know, the how liberal her state is of any senator in the country. So that doesn't give a lot of comfort. I do think she's running a great campaign right now.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think she, to me, she has offered in her economic patriotism framing of her policies, to me, she has offered the first serious counter to Trumpism to really come from the left in terms of an overarching framework.
I agree with you. I appreciate that a lot.
So maybe somebody, maybe somebody else can pick up that framework. And
well, they may be, but
and maybe when people get to know her, that you know, maybe that dynamic shifts.
So I don't want to, I don't want to sell her short though, because I think an Elizabeth Warren on a debate stage with Donald Trump would be very uncomfortable for Trump.
I think so, too. And she knows her stuff.
She knows her stuff, and she will beat the crap out of him on the easy stuff he doesn't know. Not the hard, complicated shit. On the easy stuff that he doesn't know, she will have a field day with him. But that does not mean that the country will say, I'll take her over him. And I think that there are too many examples that sort of throw up flares for me. Here we, as we sit here at the end of June in 2019, that we can project and say, well, this is how it's going to be in September of 2020. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that right now I don't see it. I agree with you that, you know, if someone else kind of takes that mantle and reshapes it, and I appreciate how she's forcing the Democratic field now to actually get into policy and put out positions on things, which will be interesting to watch in the debates coming up.
It's actually very hopeful.
Yeah,
that,
no, it is. It is.
She's running on policy and it's working. Like, you know, like it's actually very hopeful people care about those sorts of things. You know, I mean, I'll tell you, I'm deeply concerned about Trump getting reelected. I don't think this is a cakewalk. I think, you know, I agree with you that although there are many flavors, none of them, they don't inspire a lot of confidence. And, you know,
Who are you behind? Who do you like right now? I don't want to put you on the spot like, who would you vote for?
Look,
but who do you like?
I'm your firmly in the progressive
liberal,
wing
sorry.
Of the I'm firmly in the progressive wing of the party. And beyond that, you know, you asked me, you know, electable versus woke. And to me, it's not enough to beat Trump. You've got to also deal with the movement. And I don't think you do that with incrementalism. I don't think you do that by going back to the Obama era. I think you have to actually deliver real tangible benefits to the multiracial working class in order to be able to move beyond this period. So, you know, FDR had this quote. He said that it was time to be fairly radical for a generation. And I believe we're at a similar time. You saw at that time it was, you know, the wake of the Great Depression. It was the rise of fascism overseas. And here as well, I mean, we had those strains of that movement here too. And the way we defeated it was through the New Deal, was through, you know, providing jobs and economic benefits. That was how we were able to avoid a similar fate as what we saw abroad. And I believe that's what we have to do at this time. So that puts me in the Sanders, Warren, or actually like Andrew Yang, who's like obviously
he's kind of cool. I like Andrew.
Outsider. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he is a good guy. I find his policy prescriptions to be intriguing. Not necessarily realistic, but intriguing. I mean, yeah.
He's got a different
Write me a check
approach.
If you want, but you know, I don't know where you get the money from, but okay.
It depends on how you do it. I mean, there are actually a lot of, and I know you know this, but there's a lot of conservative thinkers that are behind his universal basic income idea because it's actually a way to streamline government. I mean, right now we have this very paternalistic social welfare system where, you know, we say, okay, you can have this much for housing, here's your food amount, here's what you can spend it on, right? It's very piecemeal and it's very paternalistic. And it requires a lot of government bureaucracy. You could get rid of all of that if with universal basic income. If everybody's getting, you know, in his model, he calls it a freedom dividend, but in his model, you get $1,000 a month. Everybody gets it. It's a lot easier to administer. There's no, do I qualify? Do I not? What's it for? What's it not for? You just, you get it. That's it. So well, that's why
there were a lot
that's
of
why a lot of libertarian thinkers actually support the idea. And I might add, in terms of American politics, Richard Nixon tested a program and came very close to pushing and passing a very similar idea back in his time.
It's not surprising. So, Nixon gave us affirmative action, so that's not surprising at all.
He was the EPA too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he gave us EPA and affirmative action. And to your point about there are a lot of conservative libertarian thinkers behind Andrew Yang, just as there were a lot of conservative libertarian thinkers and policymakers behind Obamacare. Because they were the authors of the Heritage Plan, which became the foundation for
the Romney Plan.
For the Romney Plan, which became the Obama Plan.
Exactly. Obamacare.
Right. So,
So we should have just gone from single player from the start,
well,
Michael.
We'd
be in better shape now.
we can have that debate. My point is, I've always chastised the party. You can't walk away from shit you own. I mean, in other words, that's one thing that bugged me about Romney. It's like, dude, they call it Romney Care for a reason. You pass this in Massachusetts, just own. So when you're asked about healthcare, say, yeah, this is what I did for my state, and this is why, you know, kind of deal.
And I know how to fix it. Right?
And I know how to fix it because I can see where it doesn't translate nationally, et cetera, et cetera. But be that as it may. So you raised with Yang this idea of sort of this this idea of an income, a new, what did he call it?
Universal. He calls it a freedom dividend. That's his spin on it. But it's the policy term is a universal basic income.
It ain't free and there's not a dividend. But okay, we'll go with that. So because somebody's paying for it and we know how dividends work. But that raises for me the battle that's beginning to emerge within the Democratic ranks over reparations. You had this week, the House panel, House committee have this hearing in which Cory Booker Tennessee Coates and Danny Glover came to the table and made the case for H.R. 40, which was a bill that set out to study. How the U.S. Would implement reparations to Black Americans. Now, here's my problem. I've been in a whole lot of meetings with Black folks, and every last one of those meetings have never begun with nor ended with the topic of reparations. So I don't know who decided that this was a priority for Black folks, that this is going
That's
to be the lead-off conversation given what we see happening in Baltimore City right now. Again, what we've seen happen in places like Chicago, you talk about healthcare, you look at the healthcare disparities between African Americans. We're not getting into the wage discussion, which this reparation, even if you got it, one time shot doesn't mean it's going to close any gaps. So I don't understand why instead of telling Black folks, oh, we're just going to have a conversation about giving you something, that we actually have a conversation about what do you need us to do, and we get behind that and do it. Because I'm telling you, my estimation, look, if we get to the point where we get all the important shit done, then we can talk about reparations, because I think it's a valuable conversation. Unlike what Mitch McConnell thinks, there should be some accountability for what happened 150 years ago, even though you didn't do it, Mitch. Your granddaddy and your great-granddaddy had a hand in it, all right? So if I love how white folks turn off lineage, you know? It's like,
they're
so proud to say, well, my great-grandpappy served in the Civil War. Right, okay, but now I'm telling you got to reparate for that shit. They're like, well, no, you know, you can't hold me accountable for what my great-great-grandpappy did. You know, come on, stop it. So I want to have that conversation. My point is, Crystal, now is not the time to have it when there's so many things that are much more pressing and vitally important to African Americans, starting with Black Lives Matters and going from there.
It's very interesting. I mean, I would say that I think you could always make that argument, right? Like, well, not now, right? Like maybe in the future, but now's inconvenient moment.
I'm not saying it's inconvenient. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying not now and maybe in the future it's inconvenient. I'm saying let's do it, But let's prioritize it on the list of things that actually need to get done.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. Have you seen any polling? I haven't really seen any polling on
wait,
reparations.
Folks saying about reparating stuff to black people? Are you kidding me? No, ain't no polls on this.
That would be very.
No.
That would be interesting.
How do you
to
feel
see.
About reparations? Repa what? No, that. No.
But I mean, I'll say I. There's a couple things. I watched the some of the hearings,
right.
And you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates is obviously a genius and incredible on this and many other issues, and makes an incredibly compelling case. I mean, I listened to what he and others have to say, and it's like, you are absolutely 1,000% correct, right? This generational harm was done that was perpetuated, and we're not just talking about slavery, right? On throughout the generations and continuing in certain respects up through today. But, you know, the disparity in wealth between the white community and the black community is still a legacy of those harms that have been done for generations throughout our nation's history. And is it right and fair for some amends, whether it's token or real, to be made for that harm? Yeah, it's right. It is morally just. It is absolutely correct. And yet, if I'm being totally honest, I worry very much about the way that will be. I worry very much about the way that white people are going to receive that. I mean, there's just no like nicer way to put it. And it does scare me that it will make our politics even more divided, racialized, et cetera. You know, I'm uncomfortable saying that, right? Especially saying
but
it
you
to you.
But you know where
but
we
like,
are. We know where we are.
But it's, you know, but it's
imagine
like,
Trump riffing on reparations.
That's just
why would he do that?
The truth.
Yeah, why would he do it?
Right.
He wouldn't do it because he's trying to encourage white folks to get behind the movement.
No, of course. Of course. I mean, and so that's my fear, is that white America, unfortunately, is not there. That's my fear. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but that's
no,
what scares
me.
And
think,
again, they're right. Like, they're 1,000,000,000% right. And I think on a karmic level, this is something that another, you know, outsider candidate, Marianne Williamson, talks about. Like, on a karmic level, if you believe in those sorts of things, I think you can't close that chapter in our history until you really have, like, made amends in the best, like, some sort of real, sincere kind of way. And we have never done that. So
well,
it does just kind of hang out there,
it
you
does.
Know?
No, it does. You're absolutely right. And I think to your last point, the way you begin to do that is just acknowledge the stuff we've done. Just acknowledge the contribution we've already made in spite of being slaves, in spite of Jim Crow, in spite of segregation. We still, for whatever reason compelled us, built this country and tried to help it as well as ourselves live up to the ideals in our founding documents, even though those founding documents saw us as 3/5 of a person or didn't recognize us at all. I think that simple testimony starts a whole lot more of conversation and I think begins to get to a very valid point that you make about how uncomfortable it is for white folks to really get into this. And more important, my concern with this current conversation is, one, it's happening in the context of politics. So it's not being driven out of a sense of there's an inherent positive reason, rationale for doing this that goes beyond politics. It actually goes to what you just said, Crystal, about, you know, where the country should be going and all of that. But that's not how this is going to get played out. And my concern is that yet again, candidates running for the highest office of the land wind up doing what candidates have always done who run for the highest office in the land. They talk a whole lot of ish to black folks. And
yeah.
They start whistling a whole lot of tunes that they think black folks want to sing to. And then they get elected and
They don't do any
they
of
cut,
it.
They, well, cut, they cut funding for HBCUs. They, you know, they promote health care that does not account for the disparities in the black community, et cetera, et cetera.
And, and deindustrialize their communities.
Yes.
I mean,
and regentrify them out of their homes. Exactly.
I guess what I would say is I wish the country was far enough along in its evolution that we were ready for this moment mm-hmm. and to move forward. And I just think we have a lot more work to do. And maybe I'm wrong, but it sure seems like we need to do some more work before we're really ready to make amends for that, even though it should be, you know, even though it's way long overdue.
Well, I will leave us on that profound point because I think it's an important and an honest one. And I appreciate your honesty on that, because that is the beginning of the conversation. When you're at least honest and say, hey, you know what? I don't think we're ready for this. and because a lot of people, as you know, Crystal, a lot of people oh, no, we can have this conversation. The minute you start getting into it, like, my mama's calling me. I got to go pick up some groceries, you know. Crystal Ball, thank you for allowing us to look into your crystal ball a little bit.
It is my pleasure.
I always love the way they play off your name. It's so much fun.
It is what it is.
It's a real pleasure having you on the podcast. She is the co-host of The Hill's daily politics show, Rising. Do catch her out on Hill TV. You'll love it. She's really good at what she does. And she's fair, folks. She's fair. So even when us conservative types get in front of the mic with her, she gives as good as she gets, but she's fair. That's what I've always loved about Crystal.
That's what we try to do. Folks can find us on YouTube, too. We're trying to get folks to subscribe over there, and that's moving along. So
excellent.
Check out The Hill over on YouTube, yep, and you can find everything that we're up to there.
And you can follow Crystal, as I do, on Twitter, at Crystal Ball on Twitter, so please check her out there. Crystal Ball, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, sir. Great to talk with you.
All righty. Well, folks, that does it for this time. We're going to have some fun next week, as we always do, with another guest. But in the meantime, do check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. I love it when you do those downloads. Love it even more when you catch me on Twitter at Michael Steele. I am Michael Steele. This is the Michael Steele Podcast. We're out. Take care.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.